So some aspects of this talk may seem a little familiar to some of you who may have been in my talk yesterday, but different beetle, similar slides. So pay attention for the differences. So male-produced volatile pheromones have been identified from 14 species in and 15 species in five tribes of the subfamily Ceramocyanae. Those tribes include the Calidiinae, the Anaglyptinae, the Clytinae, the Elaphidiinae, and the Roseliinae. Good stuff. Many of these, the pheromones of many of these species are produced from these glands, that are in the prothoraces of males. And this is the cuticle. This is a cross-section of the cuticle of Xylotrechus nauticus, and this shows that there's this layer of glandular tissue that's connected to the through the cuticle with these pores. And these, you can see the indentations in the external surface in these SEMs, and these indentations are present in males but absent in females. And the pheromones of many of these species are of a common structural motif. They're 1 to 4 compounds. They have 6, 8, or 10 carbons, and they have a carbonyl or a hydroxyl group on carbons 2 and 3. And two examples of these compounds are 2,3-hexanediol and 3-hydroxy-2-hexanone. They also, many of these species participate, like do this calling behavior in which the males stand perfectly still, stop, push themselves up, and it elevates their prothorax above the substrate, which may increase the flow of air and therefore the dissemination of the pheromone into the air. So these gland pores are present in a lot of different taxonomic groups, and these are actually tribes of the Ceramocyanae, and there are actually 38 tribes here. I've done about 170 species, but of the Ceramocyanae, I've conducted SEM survey of almost 90 species. It changes a lot, but so these are just the tribes, and you can see that there are gland pores present in the species that are in the tribes that are indicated with the plus and absent in the tribes with a minus. And then there's some tribes that have some species with gland pores and some species that lack gland pores. And you'll notice that some of these tribes, we know very little about the behavior of the adults, like the Mesodelopsinae and the Rhinotrigines. We don't know very much about their behavior. But the fact that they have these gland pores could indicate that they produce a volatile pheromone. And so that tells us something about how these kids find each other out in the wild world. So I'm today, in my little talk here, I'm going to try to convince you that the gland pore trait can guide the identification of volatile pheromones. And I'm going to use Anaphylaxis inflaticolis as our example. And I'm also going to tell you a little bit, try to convince you that generic pheromones can be used to learn about the natural history of uncommon species. And so they can be used as one of our arsenal of collecting tools. So the first part of my talk is part of an ongoing research that tests the hypothesis that gland pores, prothoracic gland pores in males are associated with the production of volatile pheromones. And species that have these prothoracic gland pores will also produce a volatile pheromone, and those that lack the gland pores will not produce a volatile pheromone. So we tested this with the species Anaphylaxis inflaticolis. This is a species that it has this push-up stance. It does this push-up stance like some of the other species that produce volatile pheromones. So that indicated that to us that maybe it's producing some pheromones, so maybe we should do some aeration. So Anaphylaxis is restricted to a few areas in the western Mojave Desert. And only, I think it's been reported from 4 counties in California, and it is, it bores in and eventually girdles branches of Lycium cooperi, that's a box thorn, and in the process it produces a series of somewhat linear holes through which it expels frass, and those are the little holes. And that's, you can find this infested host material really easily, and that's how we reared them out for this study. Anyway, so as I just mentioned, we collected infested host material from a site in the middle of nowhere in Kern County in March of 07. We noticed that it was producing the push-up stance, and we collected headspace volatiles from adults of both sexes. We identified the chemical compounds in the aeration by GC-MS. We imaged the prothoraces from adults of both sexes using SEM. And then we synthesized the compounds, and we reconstructed what we found in the males, the aerations of males. So we tested the field activity of the specific blend of compounds released by males, and also to one of the major component. I'm getting ahead of myself here with the results, but in order to explain my methods succinctly, it's important that you know that we use these two compounds. So the lures were these pressed seal plastic bags, and if you've been to the Cerambycid pheromone semiochemical symposium this morning, this photo is very familiar. We had three treatments: the pheromone blend, the 3R hydroxane, the 3R ketone, this alone, and then an ethanol control. And we used our traps in this study were 19 liter bucket traps fitted with a aluminum funnel. And we usually use these panel traps. You've probably seen in some of my other talks, but those things are no good in the desert. You set them up and they're on the ground. So they were frequently blown over. And so we used these bucket traps that were partially buried in the soil to exclude snakes and scary things from the desert. And yeah. So this is our field site. Now this is California, but there's no cities around. It's pretty much in the middle. Bakersfield is over here. Reno is over here. So this was our study site. It's in it's on the 14. It's in the middle of nowhere. About 35 kilometers northeast of Mojave in Kern County. Traps were placed approximately 10 meters apart in three transects that were about half a kilometer apart. We checked the traps every 3 to 4 days from the end of April to the beginning of June. And we replaced and rotated the lures along the transect every time we checked the traps to control for any positional effects. Differences between the treatments in numbers of beetles captured were tested with a non-parametric Friedman's test blocking by day, and differences between pairs of means were tested with a mean separation test. We identified five compounds in the headspace of males. The major compound was this 3R hydroxyhexan-2-one, and there was these other minor components. And the pheromone blend that we used in our field bioassays was constructed to approximate these ratios. And the SEM, we already knew that, well, from previous authors had commented on the dimorphism in the males and the females, and the males have these indentations, these pheromone gland pores that were lacking in females. Females have these little dimply indentations, but they contained no pits and no pores. So our field bioassays, the treatment means were significantly different. We captured zero beetles in the control. We captured more beetles with the reconstructed blend than the R ketone alone. And this is interesting, and I'll tell you in a second why. We collected 27 adults as a total. We collected both males and females, and the maximum number of beetles captured in a day were seven, and that was in a trap baited with the reconstructed blend. Now, I should have a beautiful photograph of how awesome this was, but this is in the desert. It was really windy, and what happened is these fire ants got into my traps and ate all the beetles, and so I lifted the lid off of the thing and goes, and all the light, and I'm like, no, and so I'm trying to catch little elytra and things, so that's why I don't have a beautiful photo of my impressive trap catch, sorry. So anyway, so the R3 hydroxyhexan-2-one is the major component in the headspace volatile of male Anaphis inflaticolis, and the complete pheromone blend attracted more individuals than did the 3R compound alone. Now this is noteworthy because this is the first species for which the reconstructed blend actually attracts more individuals than the 3R compound alone. And so that's of note, and that's cool. And this is also the first pheromone that we've published from the tribe Elephidiini, so that's really great. And both sexes were attracted in field bioassays, indicating that the function of this pheromone is probably aggregation, as appears to be true for the pheromones of other Cerambycine species. So we only captured beetles in the traps during three trapping periods, and that's kind of low. But when we look at the data, it's, so we looked at the minimum temperature was 4 degrees Celsius, the maximum was 40, the winds were up to like 50 miles an hour. So it's a pretty harsh place. We already knew that the desert was pretty harsh, but this is even, and so I guess what's interesting is how did the beetles cope with this? Maybe they just don't fly around. They're only active for these very few days during the appropriate time. So it gives us a little indication of what the biology is like of this pretty rare, uncommon species. So this research supports our hypothesis that Analaphis inflaticolis has pheromone gland pores. Males have pheromone gland pores, and they also produce the pheromones. So that was pretty good. So inflaticolis behaved itself. Sometimes they don't behave itself. But we had to drive out to the middle of the desert to collect it, and it was kind of like far away. And collecting longhorn beetles is kind of hard work. You have to stand out in the sun all day and stare at bushes. You have cranky wildlife that you encounter. Sometimes black lighting is a bust. This is a bunch of leaf hoppers. That was sometimes you have some transportation problems. And occasionally you have interactions with some sort of lep that gets on your neck at black lights and causes you to have rashes. So, and also, you know, you want to get into the mind of beetles, and you think, well, maybe if I acted like a beetle, I could figure out the biology. But it would be a lot easier, rather than going to these extremes, to have the beetles come to you. So we have this structural motif, the diols and the ketones. And we were wondering if we could use this as a generic pheromone lure to not only to sort of, well, for a variety of reasons. And so can we use the generic pheromone to survey for longhorn beetles? And these are a few little results from various studies from other members of the Hanks lab. So the traps of the world. Yeah, so we set these traps out in all over the place. And this site may or may not be burned now. It's where the fires are right now. But I digress. So in Illinois this past year, we collected 22 species in 3 different subfamilies. And this was in my lab mate Rob Mitchell's talk earlier this week. In California, you may have heard Larry's results. We've collected 6 species in the subfamily Ceramocyne, and including a pretty rare beetle. This is Neocleis tenuscriptus. And Lindsley said it's pretty rare in collections. And we actually captured this in a number of different places, including Placerita Canyon, which Frank combed over for 40 years. So this really indicates that these generic lures can bring these rare species in, and we can use these as a tool to understand a lot of different aspects of not only the biology, whether they use this pheromone or not, but also the phenology, community composition. It can be a really great tool to survey for longhorn beetles. So in Costa Rica, yeah, 2 weeks, 1 beetle. That made my collecting companions very happy. And then Mexico, 2006, 1 beetle, that was rainy. 2007, though, 8 species and 2 subfamilies. Look at this, that's crazy, look at that stuff. This is like a day-flying prionine. This is Colloides regalis. This is a species that Ian and I just described. This is a new species of Eudyrces. It was crazy, it was like this one day. So we really got a glimpse of what is there. And it's not a whole, these are, again, the problem of singletons, but it's still, it just gives you an idea when these beetles are active, that they're present. And in some cases, we can actually attract undescribed things, undescribed species. So, however, not to be outdone, in 2008, we didn't catch a single beetle. So it is highly dependent on weather conditions, and it can be kind of sad. But we can certainly use these as a tool with bait traps and light traps and all the other things, just to find out what's going on with some of these habitats. So I hope that I have convinced you, or at least sort of planted in your brain, that the gland pore trait, going back, can guide the identification of volatile pheromones, and that we can use these generic pheromones to survey for uncommon species. So yeah, every time I go on a vacation, I have to bring a carload of traps. So, oh, you're going to the desert? Why don't you bring some traps? Okay. Anyway, so So these gland pores can provide a convenient morphological indication that a species uses a pheromone. But some species that produce a volatile pheromone do not have prothoracic gland pores, as I mentioned yesterday in my talk about Rosalia. And there's some other, not cerambycine species specifically, but cerambycid species that produce a volatile pheromone, but they're not producing it from prothoracic gland pores. So it's kind of a one-sided test, but it still can indicate that a species that we can learn something about its biology. So with that, I'd like to thank these people that should probably be co-authors and all these various other people for funding and help. And with that, I will take any questions. Yes? Yeah.
To attract females and other males come in potentially because
we have pondered this a lot. Yeah. I mean, it very very much could be and why is it males? Why in cerambycids is it males? In leps, a lot of times it's females. And you get into you have all these theories about sexual selection, and you can think about, well, why is it, you know, a lot of times there's some theories that, you know, it could be satellite males like in crickets or in cockroaches. And yeah, so I think about that a lot, actually. And it would be great to be able to gather some evidence that to sort of put that, you know, put that down, you know, have some idea of what's going on. Yes?
Is there any connection between groups that stridulate and ones that produce pheromones?
Well, yeah, sorry, not that I know of. As earlier today, Jim Barber, who's in the audience, prionines, which use a different type of stridulation, I mean, they stridulate using a comb on their back legs, they produce a pheromone. And that's prionine. And then lamiines stridulate, and the chemical ecology of the pheromone communication system with them is pretty unknown. And cerambycids stridulate, and they produce pheromones. So, no, I don't think that, as far as I know, I don't think there's any connection between. But if anybody has any ideas, I'd love to hear it.
In my personal history, if they're stridulating, they're pissed off. You know, it's a really different, I don't know if it's involved in
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've been in French Guiana one time where there was a tree that had cerambycid larvae in it, and you just knock on it, let them go by on the trail, and they just start stridulating.
Anybody else? Okay, thanks.